talk is holographic branching and entertainment renormalization. So what we're going to do today is, so hopefully by understanding something about the holographic principle and by understanding something about entanglement in many-body systems, we're going to build a better class of tensor network ANSATs. So hopefully be able to efficiently simulate sort of a wider range of problems. So first of all, I thought I'll begin this talk just by giving a very brief introduction to tensor network methods, so what these guys are. So I'm going to draw my tensors. So I've got my tensor A here with three indices, and I'm going to draw it as just a blob with three legs. Okay, and when I join, so a contraction of two tensors that share a single index is going to just be drawn into just visually by them sharing a leg there. Okay, so we have tensors and we can put them together. And where this is useful, so imagine I have some lattice here of n sites. So each site here is a spin half or a qubit, if you like. If I were to represent a state on this lattice, the most general way would be some wave function psi. So this is some tensor in the local basis that has n legs. So it's defined in terms of 2 to the n parameters. So this exact parameterization can only be done for small n. So it's not feasible to do large system sizes. So where a tensor network comes in, so this is a matrix product state tensor network. So perhaps the simplest type of tensor network. So instead of trying to parameterize the whole 2 to the n Hilbert space, what we're doing is only parameterizing a very small corner of this Hilbert space, so hopefully a relevant corner. So we have this collection of smaller tensors. So each of these tensors has some two of these virtual dimensions of these virtual bonds of dimension chi, and one index that connects the local basis. So this is so this representation of a state only scales at most linearly with the system size. So the goal of this is to represent the ground state or low energy state of some Hamiltonian of interest using one of these tensor networks. Okay, so immediately two questions spring to mind. Essentially, what is the best structure of tensors to represent ground states? So in particular, there's many choices, non-equivalent choices of how you connect these tensors together. So in order to understand which is the best choice, we need to understand entanglement in ground states and also entanglement in the tensor networks themselves, so how well these reproduce the physical properties that we know are there. And there is also the question of optimization. So you have to choose the parameters that define these tensors in such a way as to best approximate the ground state of your Hamiltonian. So this can be done. There are standard ways of doing this, variational methods. So I'm not going to be talking about this today in this talk. Instead, I'm going to be focusing on these much more interesting structural properties of tensor networks. Okay, so tensor network methods. I've just named a few here. I'll go into a bit more depth later on. So I think these are very exciting developments for quantum many-body systems, and that they offer the potential for a very general description of many-body wave functions. And what I mean by that is, so with tensor networks, you can often do very large system sizes, different coupling regimes, so strong, weak interactions, frustrated interactions, and also tackle different particle types. So when your degrees of freedom are spins, bosons, fermions, or even anyons. So in principle, the only limitation of whether these guys will work or whether they won't work is in terms of the entanglement in the ground state you're trying to represent. Okay, so, and these tensor networks are certainly useful, like if you, just as pure numerical methods, if you have a Hamiltonian and you want to know what are some properties of the ground state. But I think they're much more than that as well. So it's not just some black box method. So we're actually learning about the structure of many-body many-body wave functions with these tensor networks. So what the entanglement in these states looks like in some sense. Okay, so just give a brief outline of my talk. I'm going to be starting by looking at entanglement as it appears in ground states of local Hamiltonians. Then I'm going to be looking at entanglement in tensor networks. And so by comparing entanglement of ground states and entanglement of tensor networks, you can get some understanding of why they work in the circumstances they do and where they're going to fail. And this leads to the second part of the talk. So this is the new research where I introduce a much broader class of tensor networks that can be applied to a wider range of problems. Okay, so entanglement entropy scaling, we're going to start off looking at 1D lattices. So imagine I have a 1D local Hamiltonian that's gapped, and I want to look at the entanglement entropy in the ground state. And what that is so for some block of length L sites, I want to look at, if I compute the reduced density matrix for this block, I want to compute the entanglement entropy and look at how it scales as a function of L. So for a gap system, I have a finite correlation length. So entanglement is, the relevant entanglement is concentrated at the boundary of the system. So these interior sites don't have any contribution to this entangled entropy. So what this gives us is this well-known boundary law for entanglement entropy. So the entanglement of this region only scales as the boundary. So this is a very unique feature of ground states of local Hamiltonians. If I were to take sort of any random state on this lattice, it would almost always have this bulk law for entanglement. Okay, and a 1D critical system, so now I have some polynomial decay of correlations. So all of the interior sites will always contribute at least something to the block entanglement entropy. So what this gives us is a critical system has logarithmic scaling of entanglement entropy. So the point we want to take away from here is that in both of these cases, gapped and critical, the entanglement entropy scales much, much less than bulk scaling. And this is the feature that we are going to exploit in order to efficiently deal with ground states of local Hamiltonians. In two dimensions, things are very similar. So we want to look at, again, the entanglement entropy of some region of the lattice with the rest of the lattice. Okay. For a 2D gap system, we have something very similar to the 1D case, where entanglement is concentrated solely around the boundary of this region. So we get a boundary law for entanglement. So entanglement scales as L, as opposed to bulk scaling, which would be L squared. Yeah? Yep.
A few minutes late here, but this bulk estimate here, how do you immediately see that? Goes as the L squared scaling there?
Are you saying the area of the bulk is L squared and entropy does not scale with it?
How do you immediately see?
Yeah, you say as opposed to the bulk here where it scales, so it's just a statement that the area of the bulk is L squared versus the bulk.
Yeah, if you didn't have any locality in your system of entanglement, if this one was just as likely to be entangled with this one as one near it, then, of course, entanglement entropy would just scale as the number of sites.
Okay. Yeah.
So this is some sort of statement about locality of entanglement. Now, for a 2D critical system, something much more interesting happens where, so now we have polynomial decay of correlations, but we can get both boundary law and logarithmic violation of the boundary law, depending on the system. Okay, so these are the scaling of entanglement entropy for ground states of local Hamiltonians with free fermions. So these have been rigorously defined, but it's believed that these hold in general for ground states of local systems. So what we have is instances of the boundary law, which in 1D is constant and 2D is out, and we have instances of logarithmic violations of the boundary law. So the good news is these ground states order in such a way that entanglement is much, much less than bulk in this. And the entanglement will be for an arbitrary quantum state. So these ground states are very special.
The gap in critical one region from studying the entanglement, the SL.
So in 1D, in 1D,
in 2D, in scale like L.
So in 1D, you can distinguish gapped and critical phases. In 2D, you cannot. Like if you get L entropy scaling, it could be gapped or critical. So typically, these ones here are when you have a point Fermi surface, a Dirac point, and these ones, these L log L, are when you have an extended surface of zero modes. So I'll talk about this later. I don't know. I'm not so the subleading contributions aren't a concern for us, essentially. So these are the states we want to represent, and how well we can do it, of course, depends on how well our tensor networks are reproducing this entanglement that occurs. Okay, so we'll look at tensor networks now. So I've already shown you this matrix product state tensor network. And this is the generalization for a 2D square lattice here. So this is called a PEPS, projected entangled pair states. So these are tensor networks that are connected according to the interaction geometry, the geometry of the lattice. So I have one of these tensors for each lattice site. So we call this, I'm going to call this the physical geometry. So we want to look at how, for a state defined in terms of an MPS, how the entanglement entropy of this block of L can scale with the size of the L. And what we see is that for any L, there are only two connections between the block and the outside of the block. And what this means is the entanglement entropy saturates as a constant for any state defined in terms of an MPS. For the PEPS, what we have is we have order L connections between the block and the outside of the block. So entropy, entanglement entropy scaling for a PEPS state scales with the boundary law as well. So in both cases, these tensor networks in the physical geometry have a boundary law for entanglement entropy scaling. Or to put more simply, entanglement entropy scales as the boundary of the region. So S of A scales as dA. So now we're going to look at a different class of tensor networks. So as I'm going to formulate it in terms of this coarse graining transformation U. So this takes so this is some transformation between a lattice L and a coarser lattice at the top, L prime. So it's a linear map in terms of two tensors I call disentanglers and isometries. So this is known as entanglement renormalization. It was proposed by Giffray Vidal a few years ago. And by layering these renormalization transformations, so many layers, I can build this new tensor network, which I call a mirror, which multi-scale entanglement renormalization ansatz. Okay, so this is, so we have a 1D lattice here, and this is some tensor network built in two dimensions, where, so we associate this extra dimension to a length or an energy scale. So there are, there's some very nice connections between this mirror and holography. So Brian Swingle wrote a very nice paper about this. So rather than connecting tensors to try and reproduce the geometry of the lattice, I'm going to say that this tensor network reproduces the holographic geometry, and I'm going to explain more about that soon. So we want to reproduce the pattern of entanglement in the ground state.
you lose the Schwarzschild correlation.
So lower layers encode short-range information about the state, and higher layers encode the long-range information.
Okay.
So you don't lose the information that's encoded in these tensors when you go up. Okay. So I'm going to say briefly, just to give you an idea of trying to connect some dots here. So how this relates to anti-sitter CFT correspondence. So if I have my CFT in 1 plus 1 dimension, so living on the boundary of the cylinder, ADS CFT tells us it's related to this anti-de Sitter space, which lives in the interior of the cylinder. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to take my 1D mirror and just, for a periodic system, and just join the two boundaries together. So this structure here, all I want to say about this is that it looks like anti de Sitter space in terms of some of the properties. Namely, so the natural measure of distance on this tensor network is in terms of how many tensors I have to pass in order to go from point A to point B. And this looks like this negative curvature of the anti de Sitter metric. We'll see a bit more of that soon. Okay, so now we're turning to the question of how the entanglement entropy of a mirror state looks. How much entanglement entropy can this mirror state have? So we have some region A in our mirror. We want to look at what the entanglement entropy is. And what this looks like is the entanglement entropy between this region and the outside. We draw some geodesic between the two boundaries, so this cuts through the minimum number of links here and in the interior. And this, the number of links here tells us how much entanglement entropy this block can have. So with the mirror, entanglement entropy scales not as the boundary of A, but of the boundary of this holographic region associated to A. So this is very similar to the principle of holographic entanglement entropy, where you can evaluate the entanglement entropy of your conformal field theory as some geodesic in your anti de Sitter space. So we're essentially doing the same thing here. Yep. So all we need to do now is count how the length of this geodesic, in terms of the number of links you cut, scales with the length of the region A. And this is a very simple calculation. So for a block of length L, we have log L layers contribute, and each layer is contributing a fixed number of links. So this 1D mirror, which is based in the holographic geometry, can produce violations of the boundary law, so this log L entropy scaling. Okay, so we're going to do the same thing for 2D mirror now. So 1D mirror was built of this layering of these tensors and building many layers of this renormalization transformation. In 2D, it works pretty much exactly the same way. So we're looking at our lattice from the top, and we build these layers of these disentanglers and isometries. So we're sort of building the structure on the lattice, building outwards. And again, what we want to do is look at the entanglement entropy of some 2D region A with the rest of the lattice. And again, it's the boundary of some holographic region associated to A. But for the case of the 2D mirror, when we compute at the lowest level, there are L order L connections. At the next highest level, this region has shrunk, and there's only L over 2, and then L over 4, and then L over 8. So when we add up all these contributions, so no matter how big L is, it always saturates to the boundary law. Okay, so even though, so in the case of a 2D system, in essence, the area of the surface area of omega A is equal to the area in the physical geometry. Okay, so this is So this mirror lives in the holographic geometry, and for 1D we get log L scaling, but for two dimensions and higher dimensions something strange happens, then we only get boundary law in each case. Okay, so now we proceed to our
principle, extend, you know, 1D, 2D, 3D. Would the story go the same way? Just cranking up the dimension.
I mean, we have 1D, 2D, 3D, that's fine. In principle, it's fine. Computationally, it might increase your cost when you do your numerics.
Right. Well, so far, I haven't seen you come. We're not.
In principle, as a coarse gradient transformation.
And is this last bit of the story, the 2D, is that characteristic then of all the higher dimensions?
Yeah, so all higher dimensions will be a boundary law. So this is, this is observed in nature as well, like your conformal field theories. Yeah. The same thing. So now some comparison. So we've seen matrix product states and HEPs, these tensor networks which reproduce the physical geometry of your lattice, have a boundary law for entanglement entropy scaling. Yep, and so this gives some understanding of why these methods work in the cases they do. For instance, this matrix product state is the network that the density matrix renormalization group, so a very powerful numeric method for 1D systems, is based upon. So this works really, really well, fantastically well for 1D gap systems. MPS cannot reproduce the logarithmic scaling characteristic of critical 1D systems, but on the other side of things, it's really, really computationally efficient, so you can actually reproduce log L up to reasonably large L. For 2D systems, these PEPs, they're relatively new, but they've been shown to work really well in a large number of examples now. So they've been used to describe first and second order phase transitions, frustrated magnets, interacting fermions, all on large or infinite 2D lattices. But again, there is some class of problems which they will completely fail for. Okay, now with the mirror. So this is our tensor network in the holographic geometry. So for 1D systems, does a really good job of both gapped and critical systems, so provides some very natural description of quantum critical systems in 1D. For 2D systems, it's had many of the same successes as PEPs, where we've described sort of a large number of, well, a variety of systems on larger infinite 2D lattices. But again, there's this class that cannot be described efficiently with mirror. Okay, so this is how things stand at the moment. So we have these new simulation methods for 2D lattices. They're still undergoing a lot of development. They're being improved every day. So they've been shown to work quite well for these problems. And as the methods get more efficient, then I'm very optimistic. I would say most problems in this category will sort of be solvable by these methods, but there is still this class of L log L problems in 2D. So examples of that are Fermi liquids and so-called spin Bose metals that Matthew Fisher has done some work on. So these cannot be addressed by current tensor network techniques.
Can I ask, can we take a step back?
Yeah.
When you were talking about the mirror and the holographic tensor networks, or what, mm-hmm. it seemed like, I guess in 1D, you were naturally getting this logarithm, but then you said that it also naturally describes the gap system. So what about the story changes when you do a gap system?
When we're computing entropy scaling, it was essentially upper bound entropy scaling. So you can always get less than. So remember when we're building our mirror in layers, if I'm describing a gap system, then I only need a finite number of layers, then I stop, as opposed to a critical system which layers sort of infinitely.
Okay.
So
when you said your system can do interaction fermions, what type of models do you mean?
So again, this is only very basic stuff so far. So it's only the algorithms were only developed last year, but they've done sort of TJ model and things like that. So I mean, we'd like to progress into harder models. So this is sort of work in development. I mean, there is no fundamental sort of issue. It's only a computational issue that needs to be addressed.
So how's the TJ model different from a Fermi-Liquid? You can turn off the interaction and solve the system. I mean, TJ model can have a Fermi surface, right? So
well, TJ model without a Fermi surface.
Okay.
So in some sense, so from a practical standpoint, this is not good. That there is this class of models that we cannot address, and from a conceptual standpoint, I don't like it that there is something about the entanglement in these systems that we don't understand, at least in terms of how to efficiently characterize this entanglement. Okay, so this brings us to the second half of the talk, where I'm going to introduce a new class of tensor networks called a branching mirror. And this new class is sort of being designed to be able to capture this L log L scaling into V. And so what we've, and where this branching mirror comes from, so we've seen entanglement scales as the boundary of a holographic, the boundary in a holographic geometry. And what we're going to do is introduce exotic holographic geometry, so some more general structure in this extra dimension corresponding to the energy scale. And so what we'd like to achieve is a good ansatz for 2D systems with a 1D Fermi surface, and also some understanding of the entanglement in these systems, so where this extra entanglement is coming from and how it can be addressed efficiently. Okay. And where this starts is actually in terms of the notion of decoupling and many-body theory. As a sort of canonical example of what I mean by decoupling, if we consider a 1D system of electrons, it's well known that at low energies, the spin degrees of freedom and the charge degrees of freedom sort of no longer couple to each other. So you get this phenomenon of spin-charge separation, okay? So, and as perhaps a more relevant example, in 2D systems, the 1D Fermi surface or a 1D Bose surface, so there's been sort of many conjectures or works that relate this 2D system with some surface of modes. There's been many works to suggest that in the low energy regime, this actually looks like a collection of 1D gapless modes. Yep. Okay. So first of all, we're going to simplify our notation where I'm not going to draw the tensors anymore. I just draw my mirror in terms of these blocks here. Okay, so this is my normal mirror for a 1D system. Okay, and recall it was based upon this coarse graining transformation called entanglement renormalization, where you have disentanglers and isometries. So these isometries take two sites into one, but equivalently they can be written as unitary transforms that take two sites into two sites, where I've just fixed the output of one site in a particular product state. So in order to go beyond this, what I'm going to do now is instead of fixing all these sites in a product state, I'm going to put all the second sites into a new lattice. So what this is doing is this is some new coarse grading transformation that takes one lattice into two distinct lattices. And And so I call this structure that we form, I call a branching mirror. And so where this could be useful, so again, we'll go back to spin charge separation. So imagine we have some 1D lattice here of electrons. So what we can do is we have this coarse grating transformation that reaches lower and lower energies. And at a certain energy scale, my spin degrees of freedom and my charge degrees of freedom no longer couple to each other. So I can put all of my spin degrees of freedom into one theory and all of my charge degrees of freedom into the other side, and then treat each theory separately. Okay, and where this is useful, of course, so we have this new type of ansatz, this new type of mirror now. And recall, so entanglement entropy scaling of a block of length A was some geodesic in the holographic geometry. And by introducing this branching in the holographic dimension, what we have is, so we've increased the length of this geodesic. So now, beyond this branching, we now have two contributions to entanglement entropy. So when we, so beyond this branching, when we count entanglement entropy, each length scale gives us twice the contribution. So by doing this branching, this separation of degrees of freedom, we have we can allow for more entanglement entropy. So it's very convenient at this point to introduce the notion of a holographic tree. So what this is doing here is this is some way of characterizing this extra structure we're introducing in the holographic dimension. So a normal mirror would just have some straight tree without branching. And this one I introduced before has just a simple branch that takes one theory into two theories. But in principle, we could have sort of an arbitrary structure, an arbitrary holographic tree in this dimension. So just to be clear, what this is doing is, starting from our original theory, at low energies, we have a collection of independent theories, and this tree structure is telling us how we go from one theory to many theories in terms of different degrees of freedom becoming decoupled from each other at different length energy scales. So first of all, we're just going to consider very simple holographic trees. So these ones that are regular holographic trees with some branching. So a binary tree and a ternary tree. So if we have a one-dimensional mirror that has branching described by a binary tree, what we have is, so each coarse grating transformation takes one theory into two theories and so forth. And if we count up all the entanglement entropy contributions that we get from doing this, this actually reproduces bulk scaling. So this is some ansatz for 1D that actually produces S of L equals directly to L. So, and the reason it does that is we're not actually truncating any degrees of freedom, we're just separating them into different pieces. For a 2D mirror now, so a 2D mirror based upon this binary tree. So recall, when we just had a normal 2D mirror, we only had one branch. And when we added the contributions L plus L over 2, L over 4, L over 8, it saturated to L. Whereas now, because we have many contributions to entanglement from each length scale, so we have L, and the total contribution from this length scale is L and L and L. So what this means, so we have log L contributions, and each one is the same size. So what we have is, so this ansatz, this new branching mirror based upon this tree, gives the S of L equals to log L, L log L, entropy scaling. Okay.
At each layer, am I losing degrees of freedom or not in this?
In this case, you are losing half your degrees of freedom.
Okay.
So, yeah, so L times L goes to L over 2 times L over 2, but there's two of them. Okay, so we have an ancestor that reproduces this, the right amount of entanglement entropy, but so this is a necessary, but certainly not a sufficient condition that we can simulate, say, fermions with a one-dimensional Fermi surface. So just as a very simple test, what we're going to do is take this very, very simple, the most simple free fermion model that has a 1D Fermi surface and has a known and has a ground state that's known to be L log L, and we're going to try and encode it efficiently in terms of this branching mirror structure. And what we find is that indeed it can be encoded efficiently. So first of all, if we just try and use a normal mirror, so one without branching, what we find is that, so this represents the local entropy, the block entropy, at different levels of coarse grading, so as we go up. And with the normal mirror, this blue line here, what we have is that the entanglement, the local entanglement, increases each time we coarse grain. So computationally, it's getting more and more difficult, so we cannot deal with this increase in entanglement in an efficient way. What we have, these blue X's here with the branching mirror, is that we coarse grain into two different theories, and then four different theories, and then eight different theories. But at each level of coarse graining, the local entanglement in these theories remains fixed at some small amount. So rather than having one very entangled theory, we have sort of eight less entangled theories that we sort of deal with separately. So this this is one of the main results of this work we have in preparation, is that this branching mirror appears to be a good ansatz for fermions with a 1D Fermi surface. And the fact that these are free fermions is not actually really a concern to us. So the fact that we're doing everything in real space, we would hope that, say, Fermi liquids would be just as easily simulated with this method. So the only concern to us is the entanglement in real space, which is probably similar between free fermions and Fermi liquids. Okay, so this is some more complete table of spatial dimension versus dimension of Fermi surface. So entanglement entropy scaling of free fermion models. So what we see is that on this diagonal, you get logarithmic violations exactly where the Fermi surface dimension is one less than the physical dimension. And what we have with our branching mirror, so when we compute the entanglement entropy of our ansatz, we get exactly a one-to-one correspondence, so long as we choose branching in some way related to the dimension of the Fermi surface. So two things here. First of all, it seems we have a very natural ansatz for these fermionic systems. And hopefully we've also brought to the table some understanding of the entanglement in these phases, some understanding that all of these entanglement law, entropy scaling laws that we see can all be interpreted geometrically as some boundary when you put it in the right holographic geometry. What I've shown is, if we write entanglement entropy as a boundary law multiplied by some correction, then by choosing the branching of our ansatz appropriately, we can reproduce boundary law, logarithmic violation, or bulk scaling in any dimensional lattice. But further than that, we can actually, by considering more general holographic geometries, you can actually get almost any corrections of the boundary law along this line that you want. So sublogarithmic corrections, superlogarithmic corrections, so polynomial or powers of logarithms. So this seems very interesting. So Now, our NSETS has these scalings, but how come, do these scalings appear in nature? Can we find them anywhere? So I'm going to finish up this talk by giving an example of a 1D system that you can construct that actually has this log L squared containment entropy scaling. So this is some class of critical 1D system that's probably not really been observed. And how this 1D system with log L squared can be described in terms of a branching error. Okay, so just finishing up here with the last example. Okay, so if I choose my holographic geometry to look like this, so this is not a regular tree, so at each level I get one branching, but each of these branches doesn't branch any further after that, so each of these is like some conformal field theory that branches off the main theory at each length scale. And if I evaluate the entanglement entropy of a state that has this holographic geometry, what I get is, again, I have log L length scales that contribute to a block of L, but at the largest length scale there are log L contributions, so overall the entanglement entropy of a state in this geometry goes as log L squared. So can we find, so this is the ansatz, can we find a ground state, a Hamiltonian that has a ground state entropy scaling log L squared? The answer is actually yes, quite surprisingly, with a very simple Hamiltonian. So this is a free Fermion model, so just some Hopping term. So we have some non-local interaction that two fermions interact with some strength that is proportional to 1 over the distance squared, multiplied by some phase here. This phase is a logarithmic spacing. Okay, so I'm going to quickly explain and demonstrate exactly why this model has this log L squared and why it can be interpreted in terms of a branching structure. So just some simple models first. If I have a gapped Hamiltonian, say gapped icing model, it has a flat holographic geometry, so only short length scales contribute, and a dispersion relation that looks like that, potentially. If I have a critical system, it has a holographic geometry that continues all the way up, so all length scales contribute, and you may have some dispersion like this. Okay, so what does this strange holographic geometry correspond to? So my proposal was something like this, where you have some dispersion that has an infinite number of zero modes that are nested increasingly close to the origin. So as you go to lower and lower energy scales, you see more and more zero modes sort of appear. So this was my proposal for what this holographic tree corresponds to, this dispersion here. And actually getting this Hamiltonian actually was working backwards from the dispersion. So this is not something I have any physical motivation for. This is essentially an example I've cooked up, but a very interesting one nonetheless. So what we're going to do is study a phase transition where we start off with non-zero chemical potential. So here we only have two zero energy modes, and as we go to zero chemical potential, we're going to see more and more zero energy modes appear. So in terms of the tree structure, at this chemical potential, it would just be in the XX model universality class. It's, again, some smaller chemical potential. We now have six zero energy modes, so it would be, in the low energy regime, it would look like three times the XX model. And at this zero point, then we get an infinite number of branches coming off as we go to lower and lower energies. Okay, so this is a free fermion model, so I can compute entanglement entropies exactly or to high precision. And when I do this, what I find is consistent with our beliefs here. So at zero chemical potential in this model, you get this log L scaling for all L, for all lengths, with some coefficients that might have some nice properties, some nice values. I'm not quite sure of that yet. And for any non-zero chemical potential, you get log L scaling initially, but it saturates at log L scaling with a particular value of the central charge, depending on how many zero modes you cut. Okay, so this was hopefully a very simple example of some very strange phase transition between log L squared phases in a 1D system, and how this phase transition can be understood in terms of the holographic geometry, and also how, for instance, a log L squared phase, how this entanglement entropy scaling can be understood of in terms of a boundary law in the right holographic geometry again. Okay, so previously we had entanglement renormalization, a coarse grating transformation was related to the mirror, this class of tensor network ansatz, and this has been interpreted in terms of a holographic principle. So new to this work is that we've generalized our entanglement renormalization transformation with this notion of decoupling, that one theory can separate into degrees of freedom that no longer couple with each other. So this gives us a new class of ansatz, and which is described in terms of some exotic holographic geometry. So some holographic geometry where we've added some extra structure in this dimension. Okay, so this is some sort of formalism from going from one theory to many theories in the low energy regime if these degrees of freedom decouple. And with this new type of RG transformation, we also have new notions of scale invariance, RG flow, RG fixed points. And this new class of ansatz we call a branching mirror. So this, I believe we've sort of fulfilled our goals with regards to that I introduced before. So we wanted some class of ansatz that could address these 2D problems with a 1D Fermi surface, these L log L problems. So some better class of tensor network ansatz that goes beyond previous ones. But also we want some understanding of entanglement in these systems. And so we have some holographic interpretation of where these entanglement entropies arise from. And further work, we would like to develop, for instance, this branching mirror as a method to efficiently simulate these very challenging problems in condensed matter physics, like interacting fermions, Fermi liquids. So we're not quite there yet, but things are looking quite promising. Okay, thank you for your attention. Any questions?
I just remember from some of the earlier work on tensor networks that this whole concept of contraction of these tensors actually doing any sort of algorithm is non-trivial. Like the topology of how you contract and do any sort of operation on these networks becomes a challenge when they become fully from 1D.
It's a computational challenge, yeah.
But is it always simply that? Is it? I mean, more than that?
I mean, there is no, conceptually, we know how to deal with fermions. We know how to contract tensor networks. It's just some computational problem that is really expensive. But this side of things is being addressed by sort of appropriate approximations and things like that. It's purely a computational problem.
Okay, so there's no reason topology of the network itself might make things extremely difficult in this branching case over some of the simpler, more fundamental physical cases.
I mean, it's still an efficiently contractible tensor network. So everything can be done efficiently. And when I say efficiently, it's so you have some bond dimension, and it's a polynomial power of this bond dimension, but it can be some very large power.
Can you detect topological entanglement entropy?
Can we detect it?
Like, for example,
I mean, in practice, it's actually very hard or impossible to evaluate entanglement from your tensor network. So all of our things here were just upper bounds. So you can certainly simulate topological phases with tensor networks. I'm not sure. And extracting topological entanglement entropy.
The topological order does not require any critical correlation usually. So user tensor network
efficient. Yeah, well, maybe.
It's still how long when it happens.
So in your picture for this last 1D model, you can understand how the entropy counting works, because as you lower the chemical potential, you just hit more and more branches of fermion flavors, more and more chiral and antichiral fermions. Mm-hmm. So you can see as you raise the energy, you get less and less branches, and so the entropy scales away. But you said this type of branching method is useful for thinking about, say, fermi surfaces of two plus one dimensional metals. How does that picture work? I don't see why there would be a separation of scales where you would get less and less branches or more and more branches through the Fermi surface.
So,
is there a physical picture you can imagine?
I mean, potentially, if you think of your Fermi surface as a limiting case of sort of many 1D modes close together, then potentially you could sort of resolve different pieces individually. So there is. So here there's a clear-cut way of, as I lower the energy, so the first zero modes I see. So with a 1D Fermi surface, you actually have, it seems, some freedom in how you sort of branch things, so you can. So essentially you do sort of put, decouple one part of your Fermi surface and another part into two separate theories.
Physically, why is that caused? I mean, here, like I said, you definitely have an energy gap between different flavors. Why are an energy difference? Why would different pieces of the Fermi surface decouple?
Well, I mean, this is what you have these tensors. So you have these layers of tensors that are sort of optimized to separate things apart from one another. So you're putting in the separation with your RG transformation, or your, so when you go to optimize your tensors, so when you go to optimize these guys, so they're optimizing to break apart the Fermi surface in some way.
I have one question. So suppose we have some Hamiltonian where we don't know in priori how the entanglement entropy scale. Mm-hmm. And then how would you choose the branching rate? Can you
I understand.
Can you test those branching rate as part of your dynamical variable, or
so again this. So how you choose what amount of branching you have. So we had so this will be need to be something that we will address in principle. So you can just try an ancestor that has branching, and if you and what will happen if that is the wrong one. So the worst that will happen is when you have a branch, if you can't decouple anything, you're going to the original theory and a product state theory, so a theory of no correlations. So you can just try lots of branches, and if there are too many branches, then like you can only decouple when this is happening in the system at that energy scale. So if there's nothing you can separate, then whenever you try, you'll just get one, your non-trivial theory and a trivial theory. That's all you can separate into.
Well, so in this formulation that you just presented, you can only you would only consider these binary trees. You can't sort of branch into three. The branching structure comes out from this, that you can only really branch into two here, right? You can't do.
So a branching of a binary tree is what reproduces L log L for a tree system. But you could, in principle, you could consider any tree here, and it would correspond to some other violation of the area law. And like I did with the 1D fermion model, you could construct a Hamiltonian that has these other violations of the area law.
It would probably be even stranger. That would be even stranger, is it?
Yeah, it would be a non-local Hamiltonian, potentially.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.